Our next speakers are with the GNU Radio Project. We have Eric Blossom as the main presenter. I'll let him introduce the project and the other people. I'll turn it over to Eric.
Thank you very much. I'm Eric Blossom, and my colleague here, Matt Edis, is up here in the front. We're going to do the talk from down here because we've got a little technical detail. Is that we're running this off of our real hardware, which is a desktop machine, and we don't have a splitter, so you know we got to sit down here so we can see the screen while we type. But I'm sure it'll work just fine. So before we get started with the quote official part, I want to just this thing up in the upper left hand corner is the that's centered on KFOG there. That spike that's right there is KFOG, and all those other things are other San Francisco FM radio stations. So that's the thing to notice is that's a 10 megahertz wide chunk of the RF spectrum right there. It's labeled from 0 to 1E07, but it's 10 megahertz wide. We'll talk a little bit later about the actual hardware we're using, but the fun stuff about what we're using with this wideband stuff is we can suck down great big pieces of the spectrum and do all kinds of stuff with it. So we'll go on from there. Easy way to find all the source code and everything on this is punch GNU Radio into Google, and we're the top link there. There's pictures and mailing list and all of the code. And we just cut a brand new tarball last night, so all the latest stuff is in there. Okay, what are we doing here? Fundamentally, this is a free software toolkit. Now, I know this is a free software crowd, so I don't have to spend a lot of time on what's free software and why that's a great thing. In a lot of the talks I've been doing, I've been to Washington to talk to the FCC. They have an interest in this stuff, and a big piece of those talks is about why free software is a great thing and tool for innovation. But what I want to talk about here is what we're actually doing is it's now possible, given the tremendous performance of today's processors, to actually build some amazing radios. In fact, you can build radios like nobody's ever built radios before. So you can build radios that work the same way that old AM/FM radios work, but you could also build new radios. And part of what happens in this game is you get to have one general purpose piece of hardware, and then you turn everything else into a big software problem. So we got some more block diagrams later on here, but we think this is a good thing. It gives you enormous flexibility that you just don't have. I don't know anybody here like ham radio operators, any amateur operators. Okay, they're waving their hands vigorously. Any of the rest of us, particularly those of us who pretty much started out as software guys, I mean, radio's always been kind of, yeah, it's that thing I buy at the store. Well, or, you know, you got a cell phone, or you got walkie-talkie, or you've got your car door remote opener. Well, we see a future where all of that is all handled in one single device. So there's really no reason I can't on the fly reconfigure I call it like the holotron, your universal communication device. Oh, it needs to open my car now. Or, gee, I really want to know where I am right now. And just by downloading, you know, basically switching in new code, it converts itself into that kind of device. There's another whole big piece of GNU Radio, which is really we want to provide an environment where people can learn about both digital signal processing and specifically about digital communications. So I got into this after doing a whole bunch of stuff with crypto, and I discovered in there that there's a whole lot of digital signal processing that goes into making secure phones. But that didn't really give me a whole leg up into the digital communications world. I mean, it gets you a certain half of the way in, and then all of a sudden there's a whole new like set of textbooks that's how you actually put it to a different kind of a use. And I looked and I said, okay, I want to learn about this stuff. Well, how do I go about it? And I was going to try to avoid, you know, it was a classic make or buy decision. So I said, well, what's already out there? And I looked around and there were some people building some really cool boxes. They had these really fancy TI DSPs and, you know, million gate FPGA and all that. And the box was about $20,000, which was like, okay, it's a kind of expensive, but it's not unreasonable given what it does. But the kicker was it took like $70,000 worth of software by the time you got all the tools it took to make the thing work. And I kind of said, wow, that really puts it way, way out of line. You know, this ought to be something that any of us could do, you know. So that was a piece of the motivation for the whole idea on this. So we're going to show what we're running today is all done with off-the-shelf parts. We're going to talk a little later about we got some custom hardware designed that we've got some people who will build it for us, and we'll have commodity software-defined radios is where we're headed. The other thing that we've been having some fun with is regulatory hacking. And what I mean by this is that, I don't know if you know, there's like, you know, in the United States, there's the FCC a while back, pretty much at the dawn of the cell phone age, decided, of course, this had to have been coming down by lobbying on the from AT&T's part, but about they said, well, you should not be able, you know, it's now forbidden to receive certain communications. Don't tune your radio to 825 megahertz. So one thing that starts happening when you've got wideband receivers is they don't see, that's like you're in outer space and somebody's telling you there's a border on the, you know, drawn on the earth, or you just don't see it. And part of this is also we've been doing some work with we've done an HD, a high definition TV receiver, and there's some stuff I'll talk about later, but a little preview is that the content people, primarily the Motion Picture Association of America, wants you not to be able to do with the content that they're broadcasting what you want. So there's been some fun and games in there, talks with the FCC, and more trips to Washington in the often to argue for the point of view that we ought to be able to do with what we want with things that are being broadcast. Okay, so what is software radio? I mean, it's kind of an oxymoron in one sense. Like, what do you mean software radio? Well, for sure we're not talking about streaming internet radio. That's internet radio. That's something else. That's a great thing. You could think of us as a potential source for that. And I like to think about it, fundamentally, the idea is we really want to get the software as close to the antenna as we can. And the truth of the situation is it's getting closer and closer and closer. I mean, ideally, you'd need, like, let's say you wanted to listen to KFOG, which is 104.5 megahertz, you'd need to sample that at, like, twice that, roughly, if you were doing it naive. So you'd need some 200 million sample per second converter to get that signal. Now, we don't, that's a lot of samples per second to grind on in your PC. So we're not quite up that high, but we're doing what's called relatively IF sampling, where you take the intermediate frequency out of your radio. So we take maybe a 2 gigahertz signal and down convert it, where we've got the band of interest. So we take the whole RF spectrum, we take a slice out of the middle of it, and we put that into the PC. So fundamentally we take about a 10 megahertz chunk, and we just digitize it directly into the PC using off-the-shelf hardware. And then from there on, it's just a simple matter of programming. So we'll show you the HDTV thing, which was actually a really fun, simple matter of programming. And fundamentally, this is all about, it's total flexible. You've got, the code is defining what waveforms are transmitted. And likewise, it demodulates. So here's the traditional radio diagram drawn in kind of radio designer lingo here. So the little triangle on the left is the antenna, the wiggly lines, there's a bandpass filter. So you said, out of the whole RF spectrum, you know, as they call DC to daylight, which part am I really interested in? And then you've got a amp on the input and a power amp on the output. This circle X thing is basically looks like a multiplier to us software guys. They call it a mixer in the RF land. And that other wiggly line thing at the bottom is an oscillator. So I'm multiplying my signal that's coming in by some fixed value, and based on some trig identity, I get the sum and the difference of those two signals out. And then that other wiggly line thing is another bandpass filter. So that gets me more of just the piece I want. And then fundamentally, I just stick it into my A to D converter and my D to A converter. Now, from here, and then it goes on to, this is actually a diagram of a traditional digital radio. If we were looking at traditional radio, like really what we've got in your kitchen and your stereo, there's no A to D or D to A in there. There's actually, at that point, a bunch of analog circuitry. A lot of it's in ASICs and stuff in the mass marketed stuff. But the point is it's specific to a given task. So in this case, in the digital radio, typically there's an ASIC in there, like inside your cell phone. The reason your cell phone will only do two or three different kinds of things is because there's some hardware in there that will only do, it's optimized to do two or three different things, period, end of story, things, period, end of story. Now, up to this point, they've had a good reason for doing that, and one of which is that we all like our cell phones to run for a long time before we have to recharge them. But there's good news on that front also. And then ultimately, in the traditional radio, there's some kind of CPU, but it's mostly running the display, or you tile your keypad and you say, you know, what happens from now. Okay, so the next one is a software radio, which kind of looks the same up to the A to D, except then you just go right to the A to D, and then you go to the CPU, and then you've got a million lines of code. So it's like at this point is where the fun starts. So our idea is that we've got a one-shot deal, you know, one general piece of hardware that really handles that whole front path from the antenna up to the A to D. Now, there's some restrictions on what you can get, but the hardware we're demoing here is actually that whole front end piece. Everything up to the A to D here, if you want to come up after the talk, I'll show you. It's in a little metal can that actually the ones we're using were designed as TV tuners. So they'll take anything from 50 to about 860 megahertz on the front end, and they basically down-convert it to where it's at 5.75 megahertz down here. So you got a signal that's centered at 5.75 megahertz that's about 8 megahertz wide centered on that. So, and then the rest of it is a simple matter of programming. Okay. So what can I do with this? So one thing you can do is you can do everything you can do with a regular radio, and you can do it with software, and it costs more money, and it takes longer, and it uses more power. So, yes, okay, we're making progress now. And of course, we had to do that first. So one of the demos we'll run is the FM radio we built, basically a $3,000, FM receiver. Go down to Long's, plunk down your $5, you get the transistor radio. No, that wasn't good enough for us. We needed something better. Other things you can do with it are spectrum monitoring. This is a classic, like a regular spectrum analyzer, a device that you might pay, $20,000 for from HP. We've got a simpler version that doesn't have quite the fancy RF front end, doesn't cover the range that they do, but we've got the complete flexibility on the kind of signal processing that they can do. If you look at some of they've got a vector signal analyzer, and they've got some other pretty neat equipment, and we've eyeballed that and demoed it, and we say, ooh, what great ideas could we take out of there? The other thing you can start doing with software radio, and this is where the fun begins, is you can do multiple channels at the same time. So you could say, well, I want, you kind of got to stretch your mind for a second, because normally we think, well, broadcast radio, well, why would I want to listen to two stations at the same time? Well, it may not be the best example, but let's say that you were monitoring a particular communications like public safety, and you were trying to gateway between, the sheriff's department and the police department and the ambulance dispatch. And the classic case is you hear the story, well, the people from the volunteer fire department can't talk to the CDF or whatever, because they're not, there's Fred. Steve, same time. All right, yay! Okay, we just need a little bit more hardware there. Okay, good, but it would work. At a certain point, it's a question of where the dollars come in here is how fast your A to D converter is. And just to kind of go out of order here, but to give you an idea on what's kind of the reality on the situation, is you can buy today these analog to digital converters that Analog Devices makes. They're designed for what they call software base stations. So these are multi-mode base stations. Okay, well, we're going to work flying. Ooh, we got past the second slide here. All right. Let me jump on here. Okay. Let me go to multi-mode. Multi-mode means I'm doing more than one thing at the same time. So I've got, in the case of the two kinds of radios that are talking to each other, I've got a device that's like looking for, say, paging traffic on one sense and gatewaying it over to another system. I've got a cellular base station that's running two kinds of cell phone protocols on the same hardware at the same time and dynamically load balancing. Better spectrum utilization is where we think there's a real future for software radio because we can build these radios that nobody's built before. Okay, I'm going to hand over to Matt here, and I've been really careful to give him plenty of time to do 10 slides.
Okay. So one of the most common questions we get on the mailing list is about what kind of hardware you need to do this sort of thing. So it really depends on what waveforms you're trying to transmit and receive. So, for example, if you're interested in narrowband things, let's say like SSB or Morse code or typical ham radio kind of mode, they're all pretty narrow band. And so all you need is a sound blaster from the sampling point of view. So there's two components of the hardware that you need to do something like this. In addition to the computer, you need some way of getting the sample, getting the signal in and out of the computer. So that's the codec or the A to D, D to A. So if you're doing narrowband stuff, you can use a sound blaster for that. And with high-end audiophile type sound cards, you can get about 100 kilohertz of bandwidth. So you can do some interesting things with that. And then, so in addition to that, you would need the RF part, which would translate from the input and output of the codec, or the sound card in this case, up to the RF frequency of interest. Because the sound card can't directly handle, you know, a couple of megahertz of center frequency. So you need an RF front end, which is a transverter, down converter, up converter kind of deal. So on the low end, the narrow band, you use basically a mixer, an oscillator, and a sound blaster, and you can do some very interesting things with that. Certainly any ham radio mode. If you move on from there, there's kind of a big jump in cost and capability, you get to the wideband sort of things. And now if you want to do something like 802.11 or TV or HDTV, you need to be able to sample a lot faster. So we've been using, for example, in here we have a 20 mega sample per second A to D converter card. We don't have a corresponding D to A, but in the future hardware that I'm working on, we will have that capability. So a wideband, a 20 mega sample per second card can deal with signals up to 10 megahertz wide. And so you can do some really interesting things with that. And at first glance, you would think that, you know, the computer really can't process that many samples. But today's modern PCs are amazingly fast. And when you're talking, you know, we're getting one or two taps per second on a filter, taps per cycle on a filter, and you have 1.5, 2, 3 gigahertz processors, you can do some really serious processing on that. So, so to go with that codec, you would have to have a wideband front end, which would translate to and from your RF frequency of interest. So, in our case here, just to describe our hardware, we've got over here is a little card that has a basically an evaluation board for a cable TV tuner. So it just down converts anywhere from, as Eric said, 50 megahertz to 860, and gives us a nice 6 or 8 megahertz wide chunk that we can then sample in the A to D converter card, which is in the computer. And this computer is a dual Athlon, 1.5 gigahertz. We're actually not really making much use of the second processor right now. When we got this was the fastest thing out there. Now there's computers significantly faster. It doesn't take serious investment to be able to process the kind of interesting signals that are out there these days. Okay. Okay. This is a diagram of what happens when we're, for example, receiving an FM signal. So this would be a narrowband FM signal that I have here. So first, on the upper left, you have the A to D converter, which comes in at 20 mega samples per second. So before that, you have the tuner that just gives you a nice 6 megahertz chunk of spectrum. And then we do some offset correction, and then we have a mixer. So we mix down from the center frequency to a baseband, we bandpass filter, and then we decimate. We try to, as quickly as possible, stop using the full, you know, 20 mega samples per second, because that's a big computational burden. So we go down, we decimate by 125, so we're only dealing with 160 kilosamples per second. We do some more filtering, some more decimation, a demod, some filtering, and all this is on the software. We instantiate objects, basically, C++ objects to do all this. And a lot of them are templated, although becoming fewer and fewer. You can kind of write a block once and it'll deal with floating point or integer or anything else, any other type that you like. So you don't have to keep rewriting things. This is the same thing times four, and that's kind of the beauty of software radios. You know, in a hardware radio, you'd have to make four copies of the hardware. Here we just kind of have a for loop and re-instantiate the blocks again. And so we have, we can have up to, you know, as many as we like, demodulations of various channels. Okay. We can show you the code later. It's remarkably simple. There's just like one line will instantiate a filter. It'll design the filter for you. It's pretty programmer friendly considering what's involved in it. We're working on getting it more programmer friendly, I'd say. Right. Okay. So what we're going to do here is we're going to demodulate wideband FM two channels. So like commercial broadcast FM. So there's we can demodulate basically any two stations within 6 megahertz of each other, because that's how wide a signal we can get out of this. So there's no real picture of the spectrum here, but on the two speakers you can hear there's two different radio stations. Yeah. Yeah, so you can actually, we've, with more speakers, we've done 4. Most of the computation burden is in the front end part, so you can add more without too much cost. And it's really you can hear twice as much clear channel at any time with it. So Eric's going to run the next demo here, which one? Okay, so now we're going to do a scanner. And so part of the... Say something subversive. So the interesting part about this demo is that we're doing too subversive. The interesting part about this demo is that what's happening is we take the 20 megahertz wide signal, we knock it down to about a megahertz there, and then we look at the two strongest signals within that megahertz, no matter where they are. So you could change the channel on there. Don't change it below number 8 because that's out of the range. And we can still demodulate it. So you can change the channels and it'll still find it, and it does 2 at once. So it's very big for surveillance and things like that. The signals are actually too strong. We're taking the antenna off here. The top graph is the 1 megahertz wide, so you can see you can see two signals there, and then on the top one you can see the two signals, and then the bottom two graphs here are the pre-demod and post-demod of the stronger one, and then the next stronger one is also demodded in the same way, but we don't have not showing the graph of it. Is there another? Right. Okay. So that comes down to your radio front end dynamic range and your A to D converter dynamic range. So 40 dB is not that big a deal. When you start to get significantly higher differences and signals really close, it really depends on the precision of your A to D converter. So for example, this thing has a 12-bit A to D converter. So the more bits, the more dynamic range you can represent. And so if your one signal is 100 dB stronger than the other, you're not really going to hear the other one. It's really a limitation of all sorts of radios. You also don't want to saturate because you get other intermod effects there. So you have some back off. So the more bits, the better. And so 12 is kind of, a sweet spot in terms of cost and capability. Yeah, so in this case, the cable TV down converter has two gain stages that are controllable over the parallel port. So you can control that and to get things at the right power level.
Another one? And the next demo we want to do is actually the world premiere. Yay! It truly is, believe it or not. So anyway, this is our HDTV demo. So what we're going to play here is that we can't do it in real time right now. And also, I set it up and I got 40-inch boom antenna to get it and all this. So We're not working on rabbit ears, but neither are the ones you buy at the store. So we think we're holding our own there. So this is some Law and Order that was recorded last week. And why don't you go ahead and punch play and then hit. This is in HD. Okay, the motion artifacts are actually a problem in the player. The thing is demodded with very few errors. There's a few errors in there, but there's some of the color splotches you see, but the interlacing is a problem with the player we're using. It's pretty slow right now. I guess the game plan here is to be able to demo it in real time sometime this year. So we got some room, we got work to do, but we got more hardware, faster hardware. Good. It depends on Okay, the question is how much slower? Right now it's actually running with a 256 tap equalizer, we're running about 40 times real time. So there's a big speed up available on the equalizer. We've got a second processor that's not currently been enabled. There's speed ups on the read solemn and decode. So there's a bunch of relatively low hanging fruit here.
Have you guys used this for actually transmitting FM as well?
Or we haven't transmitted. We didn't build an FM transmitter just because there were so many great signals around and we didn't see a reason. It's kind of like why. We did build an HDTV transmitter and we used it to test the receiver. So we haven't put it on the air, but you know, it just goes with disk.
How much software work is there to integrate GNU Radio with the IP stack, and where do you draw the line of cognitive radio in that?
Well, okay, two questions. There's already hooks in there for the IP stack. I mean, it's like, you know, the TCP source and the TCP sync. One of the directions we're headed is actually a way to be able to glue GNU Radio into the outside and sort of an event-based system also, so you can stream data in and out of it. And a better control infrastructure. Right now, we've got a system that is working right now. It's not real flexible. So once you set up this data flow pipeline, you currently can't reconfigure it. So those are some things to go. What was the second question? Oh, cognitive radio is this whole idea of radios that go, and one way to think about it, they basically are radios with some artificial intelligence in them. They would be radios that would go survey the spectrum and figure out how to make the best use of it. So, I mean, that's a whole wide open whole area. I mean, it's an area where there's lots of regulatory issues, and the FCC is interested in this in a positive way. They see it as a way to make better use of the spectrum. There's a conversation right now, like there's a scarcity in spectrum, but if you actually take a look, like you get your spectrum analyzer out there and look, there's huge gaps, so there's nothing going on. And the current policies are all based around basically 1920s technology. So right now there's active discussions being held with the FCC and actually there's a thing at Stanford, is that next weekend? The Larry Lessig's thing at Stanford Law School on basically policy issues around spectrum. So, more questions?
Have you done any experiments yet trying to combine signals from two simulcast stations?
No, we haven't.
Should make sure that you talk about the regulatory stuff. So okay. What are the regulatory
issues? That was one of the parts we whizzed by. You have a regulatory question there, Mr. Seth?
Yeah.
Okay, let me give the quick
regulatory.
Quick lowdown. Thanks for the thing. There's a move afoot organized by the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association of America, the Broadcast Protection, the Copy Protection Technology Working Group, Broadcast Protection Discussion Group. So it's a big string of random letters. What they want to do is, right now, let me just back it up a little. There's currently HDTV being broadcast in pretty much all the major markets. There's even two stations now in Monterey. So it'll get rolled out. They're the broadcasters are compelled to switch over to, now it's 2007, where analog TV will go away. What's possible now is they're transmitting things that you can pretty much demod with no errors. So if you got the right setup and your software's good and your antenna's in the right place, you'll be able to get perfect copies. So the opportunity to build the Super TiVo is around the corner. So basically how the Super TiVo works is you take the output of our thing and you spool up the disk. Then you've got some other folks that, you know, write some software to strip all the commercials out automatically, And, you know, it's, so that's where it's headed. Now, the thing is, even the compressed files are still huge. So the output, the MPEG, the high definition MPEG is about 2.4 gigabytes per minute of storage. So nobody's going to be like uploading these babies. To give you another idea, it's the uncompressed one is 2.4 gig a minute. So when we like record 30 minutes worth of show, it's like 72 megabytes. Or 72 gigabytes. So anyway, the MPAA is pushing for this broadcast flag. The MPEG stream is currently unencrypted. It's unencrypted. They want to set a bit, one bit in this unencrypted stream that says, for all intents and purposes, don't copy me. And there's a couple like little changes. It means don't copy me unless you're a member of the secret club that's cross-licensed with patents that says I really won't let it get out of our little corral. So, we've got a couple of complaints about this. One, they don't think it's very good for consumers in general. One of which is given their robustness requirements, there's no way that a piece of free software could ever meet their requirements. It's just, even if we put in all the code, I mean, we shipped it, boom, it's instantly out of there. There's also a fundamental issue around the constitutionality of what they would propose as a ban. Just like we've already found out in the crypto world, the software is treated as speech. There are more cases that support it than opposed to it. So there's active work going on. The FCC, I talked to the FCC's Technical Advisory Council in December. They are really quite receptive to this whole idea. This is a battle that I think we're going to win. So, but anyway, just to know, there is a conflict right now, and it's the content people versus everybody else. And the other thing to know is that there are other, it's not all the content people. So there are certain, the guys, HDNet, they're broadcasting. They don't want this broadcast flag. They think it's a competitive advantage. Just, hey, we're going to deliver quality content. Let's get on with it. Got time for, okay, go ahead.
And are HDTV receivers subject to patent protection? And if so, what's the impact on the project and the distributability of the software?
It's kind of interesting because I got asked that question by the Antichrist there and not Lucky, but the other Antichrist, the guy from Fox. But I believe that actually what happens is that Zenith asserts certain patents. The ones that I have seen, I don't claim to have done a full investigation. So the ones that I have seen are patents on analog signal processing. Okay, so I've looked and they've got some patent on, you know, a particular piece of analog, like an analog ASIC that does some particular part of the task. Now, what Matt and I noticed in doing this is we read the specification. It all looked like pretty much the standard out of the textbook signal processing stuff. There's a few weird things thrown in there that, you know, who knows why they did them. It's not clear to us that they make it work any better, but they're in there. So it's not clear to us. You know, nobody's come to us. Zenith hasn't sent a letter or anything, so.
How the hardware and sampling cross over. Do you have problems with like desensitization of your receiver before you even can run the A to D on it? So for things like repeaters or cell phones where the transmit, once you do have a transceiver, is that going to be a lot harder to do than just the receiver you're doing now?
I don't think the problems are any different for the software version of it than the regular hardware version. So the truth is, in the transmitter business today, pretty much it's probably not going to be a general wideband transmitter. Those are really hard to build right now. So what probably would happen is we'd build, you know, transmitters that would handle one or two pieces of the unlicensed spectrum, and the amateur guys could build ones that handled, you know, a particular handband. Kind of same situation. Wideband, and there are people building wideband transmitters, which they use active feedback basically to control them on the fly. So they linearize them that way.
Right now, if you want to sell ham radio equipment in the U.S., you have to document that it won't receive cell phones and that it can't be easily modified to receive cell phones. Can you make any assertion on that one way or the other?
Well, I don't know. I'm a software guy mostly. We're building some general purpose hardware. The Matt and some folks are building a real high speed A to D card, D to A card with a 300,000 gates worth of FPGA on it that has no RF tied to it. So we're kind of dodging the bullet, and somebody else is going to build transverters.
Does the software have, or have you considered having the feature of keeping a track of which songs, for example, are played on which channel, at what time and how many times, and produce reports based on that?
Hey, the thoughts crossed my mind. It's not a personal interest of mine that outside of the fact that, gee, you could do that, I mean, there's a couple things you could think of. So I know that there's people that want to do automatic auditing. So if you look at, you know, you're the RIAA or something like that, you'd want to do automatic auditing. I know there's some people at Philips that compute fingerprints on the songs and catalog it that way. The other thing you could think of it is your super ripper, right, where it just sucks down. It's got one leg open to the website that's pulling down the playlist, and it's got another leg open to the sky that's pulling down the radio stations and building them all. That's it.
We'll have just two more questions.
Okay.
If I want to go out and do something tomorrow, what's it going to cost for the most basic hardware to do something fun?
That's a great question. The truth is, it's possible to do something just using a sound card. Now, what we're looking for right now, and one of the things that's really on the short list for the GNU Radio project is to get this wiki set up so that we can have a place to collect all of this, because it's a frequent question is, how do I get started? And the truth is Matt and I and most of the other active people are using this wideband stuff because we work on the TV and some multiband stuff. But there ought to be kits available today that you could already buy, regular radio kits that you should be able to either already have a low output. I mean, you could take, for example, you could already do stuff if you want to do amateur packet kind of thing. They're all done over the audio output anyway. So there's some commentary on the list and some pointers to some guys in Europe are doing. They've got a new digital AM system over there. I think it's called DRM, not to be confused with digital rights management, but it's an HF long distance digital system, and it's narrow band. It's only 12 kilohertz wide. Okay, one more question.
Should we be scared of this thing as a privacy invasion device in that any random private investigator can put one of them in their car, park near a cell phone tower, and record 1,000 conversations at the same time?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, the thing, with the right hardware, you could do this, right? You could suck down a big piece of it. I mean, that's my argument is, like, always been, well, you should really use, if you care, you should use the standard operating procedure for 2,000 years, which is encrypt your communications. So that's the right answer. Same thing with the Wi-Fi stuff. I mean, it's like, okay, it's broken. Well, why don't you just run IPsec and the problem goes away? All right, thank you very much, and Matt and I will be around and answer any other questions.